This is episode 13 of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with guests Luke Vanderland and Rebecca Costa. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is Tyler Mongan, and today I'm joined by guests Rebecca Costa and Luke Vanderland. Rebecca is an American social biologist, technology futurist, and author at the Costa Group. She's a world-renowned global expert on the subject of fast adaption in complex, high failure rate environments. She's also the author of The Watchman's Rattle, A Radical New Theory of Collapse, and she has a follow-up book titled On the Verge, where she proposes the idea of pre-adaptation. Luke Vanderland is a program director and associate professor at the University of Southern Queensland. He's also the author of Foresight and Strategy in the Asian Pacific Region. And he's an advisor for my company, Haku Global. His expertise is in foresight, strategic thinking, innovation, and implementation. This is a very timely episode considering the state of the world today. In this episode, the dialogue centers around a few key ideas. One, there is a vacuum in leadership, and we have lost trust in leadership globally. And two, at the same time, we have increased our trust in AI and technology. The question that emerges from this is how can leadership utilize AI and technology to enable better decision making without limiting their generative capability? And what type of leadership will emerge that can inspire trust? So if you're interested in exploring why the old models of leadership are inadequate, why there's a vacuum in leadership, how AI and technology enable decision making, how transparency has actually decreased leadership trust, why trust is important for happiness, why we trust our technology more than we trust our leadership, how technology can trap us into analytical thinking, why we need more generative thinking in leadership, and why your executive board needs a futurist or foresight expert, then this episode is for you. Let's listen. Thank you, Rebecca and Luke, for joining me today on this episode. And as always, I want to start with this key question around what does it mean or how can leadership be more intelligent about futures given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And I'd love to start with Rebecca, if you could answer that question from your perspective.
Well, that's a big question. As you know, here in the United States, we have a presidential election coming up and asking myself the same question, actually. It's obvious that, you know, we spent the early part of the 80s and 90s working on data production, and we kind of overshot our goal. And now data is coming at us so quickly that we can't make sense of it. Most of it largely is inactionable because having too much data is the same as having none. Our brains really don't know what to do with it. So without the help of artificial intelligence, there's really no hope of putting the knowledge that we are acquiring to proper use. And I found it really interesting in listening to these presidential debates and, you know, amongst the Democratic Party, but certainly, you know, they're going to select their nominee and we're going to be, it's going to be Donald Trump versus some Democratic candidate. I find it very interesting that the words artificial intelligence or technology or science never enter into the conversation of leadership. To me, there is no future without that. The fact is that science and technology and knowledge, the kind of knowledge that we have acquired through scientific research, can literally solve every social problem that you can name. And it is a shame that leadership is not leveraging what we already have in terms of tools and what we already know in terms of knowledge. So it's a, like I said, it's a loaded question. Maybe Luke will have a better answer.
Luke, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, I take my cue from Rebecca, actually. And I refer in particular to your book, Rebecca, The Watchman's Battle, or Rattle, sorry. You know, it's a fascinating area that we're in right now. And in particular, this whole notion of leadership making decisions today that will affect the future, and, you know, getting into some kind of projection or trend, which eventually leads to systemic collapse. And that's sort of the dystopian view that is very real. My response to your question, and we look at current leadership dialogues to fathom this out, but my response is, and my research shows me, by far the overwhelming majority of leaders, whether they're political or business, are in some kind of physiological trap. Quite right. I think that what I'm seeing is that our brains have not evolved as quickly as the technology could enable us. And as a result, I'm seeing from the data that I'm collecting and the interviews I'm conducting, so I've got both the surveys and the interviews, I'm just seeing this default to a very significant focus on the present and a largely adaptive, reactive style of viewing the future. Almost as though they're predominantly unable to consider, probably due to disruption and non-linear change, but they're generally unable to enter into framing some kind of future. And so we get this environment, which is largely adaptive. And my concern is, because these leaders generally will enable the future, we depend on them across the board. Richard Slaughter sums it up by saying, I think we are losing very quickly the notion of alternative futures. Mm-hmm. I agree with Rebecca, though, that if we can engage in artificial intelligence in a ethical and moral way, we will be able to resolve a lot of our challenges. But I just don't see a critical mass in leadership adopting that view.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm like just thinking back to also what Rebecca said. You know, is it that the presidential candidates aren't talking about this, you know, AI, technology, science, or even maybe a lot about the future, because that's where the populace is at? What do you think about that, Rebecca?
Well, I don't know if that's where the populace is at. I'm going to talk about something that I haven't ever really expressed verbally before. But you know, sometimes I find my way by articulating something. So when I get done articulating this, I may say, "Nah, that's really not true." You know, I mean, that's how scientists are. We kind of work problems in real time here. But it may be that looking at political leadership to help describe these alternative futures is an old model and an outdated model. Mm. We in previous times, we looked at military leaders, you know, to help us feel safe and to pave a way toward a safer and healthier future. And we've looked at economic leaders to, by that I mean business leaders, to help us boost our economies and generate more wealth and productivity. That all of that might be shifting, And I don't know who steps in to take the place of political leaders. I just know that there's a vacuum. Back to what Luke was saying is there seems to be some kind of a vacuum of leadership occurring in the first place. I don't think we can rely on political leaders anymore to make decisions about climate change and, the kinds of energy needs, the spread of the coronavirus. We can't really look at them to find a way out, because the problems that they have failed to solve have been around now for decades and decades and decades, and the means to solve them exist and have existed for decades and decades. So, you know, if they were a regular employee and they had such a bad track record, we just fire them, right? And you'd hire someone else. But that, even that mechanism doesn't seem to be working. We elect new people and we put them into a systemic, a toxic systemic environment. And so it does nothing. You know, here comes the new boss, same as the old boss, as the Who song went. So the systemic change may be that, you know, we're not looking to military leaders anymore. We're not looking to business leaders. We're not looking to religious leaders. We're not looking to political leaders. Maybe there's a new class of leadership that has to emerge. I'd love to hear what Luke has to say about that.
Yeah.
I love what you're saying, Rebecca. And look, I think that I have the empirical evidence, and there's loads more. Including the insights coming from you, to illustrate that this vacuum in leadership is taking place. It really, and it's across all forms of leadership, right down into community leadership. And I'm not sure what the trigger is, the catalyst for this is, although I'd like to suggest possibly. And I sort of draw anecdotally from one of my research students' work. He was a federal senator in Australia, and he did a research project around the legitimacy of the Australian Senate. Now, I think this could be transposed to most political leaders, leadership structures, and systems across the world. And what he found was that due to the incredibly rapid increase in transparency, the legitimacy of these bodies started to be undermined. And so you have the public increasingly able to not necessarily actively called to account, but certainly lose trust in that leadership. And I think it's happening also in the business sectors and the policy sectors as well. I mean, even in the policy environment, policy leaders, you have this dichotomy between, liberal policy and, postmodern policy as an example, and there are many others, or conservative policy. And so what you're getting is, where does legitimacy come from? Well, it comes from your stakeholders. And the stakeholders have an increasing ability to be able to see right into the inner workings, not the input, not the output, but the actual throughput of these leadership processes, and call into question how real they and desirable they really are. And I think as a result, leaders are then retreating, and with that retreat, a lack of vision takes place. And I sense that's the dynamic that's taking place. Now, I'm sort of saying, well, this has been sparked largely by technology. Where's it going from here? And then looking forward into that space would be probably the next question.
I think that's a really great point. Is, Luke, you're saying that on one hand it's technology that's causing, or one of the causes potentially, or part of the cause of this crisis in leadership because we have more transparency. We can gather tons of information and data about the process of a leader, but also the results and outcomes and alternatives. At the same time, technology could be something that could really help leaders out. So, Rebecca, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I like, you know, I like the output of computers a lot more than I trust human beings. So, you know, and I always get a lot of, you know, pushback on that. People are all, you know, you're a human being. Why do you relate to machines better? And, you know, that probably says everything you need to know about me. But there are problems with artificial intelligence, you know, garbage in, the conclusions that are drawn are flawed. But there's more hope that machines can evolve and edit out those flaws faster than human beings are going to evolve. And this gets back to what Luke says. I mean, you know, I could use an extra appendage every time I get in my car. I've got so many different devices and things like that that I want to plug in and use. And, you know, that's not coming for many, many hundreds of millions of years. So from an evolutionary standpoint, our brains, our bodies, they evolve rather slowly. Social progress, on the other hand, begins to accelerate, goes faster. And what Luke was relating to in my book, The Watchman's Rattle, is that I point to the fact that the gap between social progress and human evolution starts getting bigger and bigger until it's untenable. And then there is what is a unilateral collapse. The collapse is really a correction. It's a correction. And the example that I use in the book is that nobody can explain to me what a credit default swap is, but I understand barter. So, you know, you know what I mean? I mean, there are all these financial instruments on Wall Street that even the people that are trading them don't know what they are. And it makes the systems extremely vulnerable because that complexity creates a predatory environment where some people say, hey, I know what's going on, and we just trust them, like the Bernie Madoffs of the world and so on and so forth. But in reality, when that gap starts to get too large, we can see historically every society has had suffered a unilateral collapse. And that doesn't mean everybody died. It just means that we reverted. That collapse is a reversion to simpler systems that are in alignment with human capability. Mm-hmm. So you and I meet in the street and you have some eggs and I have some carrots and we bicker with each other and we both think we got the better deal and we trade. That's what our brains are designed to understand. Mm-hmm. They're not designed to understand the current, the way that currency is valued. Nobody can explain that either. So we're approaching a time where we're very, very, very vulnerable. Now, one of two things is going to happen. We're either going to have a massive global economic collapse, and that's going to trigger smaller communities, people getting together, barter, you know, and we'll rebuild like civilizations before us. This time, it'll be more interesting because we're all globally connected. What will happen is we will look to machines for leadership. And maybe the next incarnation in leadership may be artificial intelligence itself. Maybe artificial intelligence won't be artificial anymore. Maybe we will be the artificial intelligence and the machine intelligence will be more reliable and more trustworthy. Frankly, if a stranger walks up to you and says, hey, it's going to rain tomorrow, do you believe that stranger more than you believe Alexa? You see, see where I'm going with this. I mean, I think we may be crossing over into an area where exactly what Luke has been saying is happening. We don't trust our human leaders, but we do trust our machines.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, I know some organizations are using AI as on their executive team now, and I know people are more, like you said, more likely to trust the data generated by a machine than somebody maybe who's even an expert in a certain field, right?
On
a
well, let me give you a quick example. This is shocking to many people, but more and more judges in the United States are relying on AI algorithms to determine arraignment sentences. And this is shocking to people, but when you think about it, we had a judge not too long ago in California who a boy was convicted of rape and he gave the boy a few months sentence. Mm-hmm. And everyone was in outrage. And the reason that he gave is, well, the boy is educated and he came from a good family.
Mm.
Well, I don't know if that should determine sentencing. He's not a judge anymore, needless to say. They kicked him out. But it eliminates racism, it eliminates sexism, it eliminates discrepancy in sentencing. You know, it may be the path to greater justice, in terms of criminal sentencing. So, you know, increasingly these judges are turning to these AI algorithms and then of course making their own judgment, but they are relying very heavily on this to determine whether arraignment, whether there should be bail, what bail should be set. And these algorithms take into a lot, thousands of considerations, prior offenses and income and prior employment and education levels and all kinds of things that a judge couldn't, with their caseloads, couldn't know all those things about that individual.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to think how a little nuance between the AI or the data is making the decision versus someone's using that information to make a decision too, right?
Go ahead. Yeah, that's a really good point. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's a really good point. I think as futurists, we even fall victim to this notion of adhering to a vision of the future. And when you look at this particular conversation around, on the one hand, we are talking about singularity in whatever form that may take. But on the other hand, we're also talking about human agency and human value and morality and our physiological ability to look at the future and contemplate the future. And it's that ability to contemplate the future that has created civilization and sustained society. Underpinning all of that, and I don't think it's an either or. I actually think what you've just said, human decision making enabled by AI, is potentially where we're headed. Certainly in the sort of medium term, and when I say medium term, I'm talking next 50 years.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's an interim in which we'll be looking guided in some way by machine algorithms. But ultimately we'll make judgment because, you can't expect a machine to show compassion. Are things that are uniquely human. And I couldn't agree with you more that I think that there's some compromise. On the other hand, when we talk about morality and all of these things, we have to remember that, at the end of the day, we haven't been modern man that long. Mm. And, I have a friend of mine who says, anarchy is like 5 missed meals away. We're suddenly, pulling out knives and stabbing each other, we're barely modern man. We're barely civilized. It's a thin veneer. And every now and again, something happens and it's stripped away and we're all in shock, except for those of us who have a background in evolutionary biology.
I think this notion of a vacuum in our current age is a really important one. And it's causing that discomfort, that vulnerability that you were talking about, Rebecca. And we just need to look at some of the signals around this. I personally would propose that the incredible and exponential growth in mental health concerns and prevalence rates is a result of this vulnerability. And where will it go? I think that systemically, those are the really big issues. We can handle pandemics. We can even handle climate change. And I believe that the human agency, as enabled by technology, is able to overcome all of those challenges. I think that it's when we as humans start, and I don't want to use the word, but I can't think of another, start decaying. And that's in terms of our own morality, in terms of our own ability. That's a really dangerous signal that we should keep our finger on the pulse of. So this vacuum that we're currently observing, I think, is a leadership's response to a lack of trust.
Well, and, you know, I want to throw something in here because you're right on, Luke, in what you're saying. There have been any number of studies of the, you know, the United Nations, of course, does the biggest study on human happiness, right? Mm-hmm. Self-reported human happiness. And every year they list the happiest countries in the world and the most miserable countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that year after year after year, there's not a lot of change within the top like 10 or 15 countries in the world. But one of the essential ingredients to human happiness is trust in government. Mm. It's that the correlation is almost airtight as to be called causation. And it's quite spectacular that those countries where people have extremely high trust in their government and leadership also score the highest in terms of overall happiness, optimism, and enjoyment of life. Mm. And so those two are inextricably linked. So I think you're really on to something when you say the transparency of being able to see what the leaders are and are not doing, and those leaders responding to that by retracting is causing a loss of trust, which is now manifesting in overall discontent, the number of suicides going up, the fastest growing pharmaceutical is antidepressants, and the fastest age group that's growing in antidepressants happens to be teenagers and infants. So there is a mental health component to that problem with leadership. And we never talk about that. You know, we're always talking about the economy or terrorism and these kinds of things. But when you hear these leaders talk about mental health, you never hear them talk about that connection between the citizens' trust in their leadership and happiness.
I'm really, really enjoying what you're saying there, Rebecca, because this kind of dialogue is just not being had. It's not being had, I think, publicly enough, and I don't think it's being had in the publications or in the literature. But it's spot on. It's exactly what's happening around us. It's hiding in plain sight, and this is where I then revert back to this idea of, we are betraying our human potential to look to the future. And this is happening in such a large scale at the leadership level, and we've got heaps of evidence of this. The question then becomes, well, what do we do?
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a report put out. It's called the Edelman Trust Barometer Global Report, and they talk a lot about just trust and how there is this huge growing gap in trust. On one hand, you have people who are, at the top, wealthier and more educated, but then there's a huge gap of just the general population that has a massive decrease in trust globally around business, leadership, politics, everything across the board. And so it seems that there is this huge leadership vacuum, but also this trust vacuum that's a part of it.
Well, it seems like leadership, it seems like more and more leaders are strengthening that narrative. I mean, we heard about fake news about 4 years ago, but it seems as though more and more political leaders across the world are referring to this fake news, and all they're doing is they're strengthening the narrative, and they're basically, I think, are making the majority of people more vulnerable. And then this notion of disowning your future or giving up your agency becomes more powerful in the hands of those leaders.
Yeah, Rebecca, on your perspective, how can we, technology could fill that gap, the trust gap or the leadership gap? I guess, how can it do that? But also, how can it do it in a way that is, that also fosters more human trust?
Well, again, you know, I get back to, we're already on that path.
Mm-hmm.
Most people trust Alexa more than they trust the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there you go. you know, I think this is going to happen organically. I believe it's already happening. Mm. You know, we trust our mobile devices to lock our houses and turn our dog feeder on. You know, I mean, we really are relying more and more on technology and science. You know, and I think that almost political leaders are, I think, growing more and more irrelevant. I think that, you know, well, first getting back to the distrust and the connection that has been made by scientists worldwide between distrust in government leadership and unhappiness, you know, at some point people grow so unhappy that they disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it's not in our biological nature to keep doing things that make us miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not programmed that way. So eventually they just disconnect from government leadership, but then that gets us back, you know, we've come full circle. What leadership do you trust? Well, I believe more and more, you know, organically, we will be trusting our devices. Then we have to worry about how those devices are used, you know, because we've got a lot of manipulation going on, you know, identity theft and cyber warfare and, you know, things that we never intended for these devices to be used for. But, you know, I always tell people there's no such thing as an invention or a breakthrough that didn't have a dark side. You know, I mean, yep. So, you know, we have to figure out how to rein that in. And I don't think we completely understand that. And with the advent of 5G and everything speeding up and machine to machine communications on the horizon, I think that our trust in machines is going to only grow by magnitudes.
Yeah, I think you again, so right, Rebecca. Stepping into the boardroom, where part of this problem can be explored, you know, my research is just showing by far a preference toward the analytical cognitive processes in decision making. Whereas we all know that we need a balance of both the analytical and the conceptual, the generative thought processes. And not to get too technical, but I actually, across, it's about 2,500 senior executives in the Asia Pacific, found a negative 25% correlation with that generative thought process. So in other words, we're abrogating, or our leaders in the boardroom are defaulting toward the analytical, the big data, the reports that are based on historical fact, and to a negative extent, relying on that generative thinking. So how do we address that? Well, I don't see it being addressed. This is the problem. If in the absence of an analytical report, those leaders then default to a multi-billion dollar consulting industry, which are all based on archaic models, to be absolutely honest with you. So I do intend being quite critical of that sector. But these leaders are after they do the analytics, they're then handing over their fiduciary responsibility to direct to a multi-billion dollar consulting industry. And so I'm not really optimistic, and I don't want to be dystopian, but I'm not, I just can't see the majority of leaders in business, because that's where the research comes from. I can't see the majority of leaders in business making that shift. The only leaders that are in that space of balancing the generative and the analytical cognitive processes are the entrepreneurs, and they're the ones that have to. And so that's the only glimmer of hope that I've seen in the data and the evidence that I've collected. So on a practical note, Tyler, you know, the bottom line is we still have humans leading our corporations. We're seeing those humans defaulting toward an analytical and advisory and compliance mode, leaving out a lot of the questions that would be answered by generative thought, agency. We talk about innovation, but it needs to start somewhere, and it starts at the top. You know, that's where we're failing. What can we do about it? Well, on a corporate to corporate or business to business basis, yes, we can change those boardrooms. But we've got a hell of a long way to go to get it systemic. And I agree with Rebecca that that's our main challenge. And that can be, I would propose that that's the same issue if you go and look in the cabinets of the world, if you go and look in the policymaking domain, even in the not-for-profit domain. I've done some research of some global not-for-profits, and they're showing the same leadership tendencies as we're seeing in the business sector. So, yeah, it sounds somewhat dystopian. I think that it's an entropy of the system that's going to lead to some kind of systemic correction.
I can't agree with you more, Luke. I keep saying that over and over again. I just sit here nodding my head up and down, you know. The one thing I think that we are not accounting for is generational change, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that does make me optimistic, in addition to the fact that technology and science itself will organically change who we trust, where we go for information and data, is that I see that the generations that will take over leadership are seem to have a better understanding that the data and the analytics is to be used. You know, it's not to be obeyed. And I think that the older people think that, you know, we worry that we're obeying the data instead of understanding that it's just information and it still needs to be processed and treated and acted on. And those are the things where human agency, you know, plays a role. But I see that younger people, particularly my nephews that are very young, you know, they're still infants, they seem to have a pretty good handle on the fact that if they see something or hear something, you know, they don't necessarily feel like they have to do that thing. And it could be that we have a rather rebellious family to begin with. As you could probably tell, that DNA is in them.
Yeah, I think that the key point is that distinction between using technology versus obeying, or data and obeying technology and data, will be a key distinction, especially for leadership in the future. I think it was just recently on the episode, I had somebody talk about Bezos from Amazon and how, you know, if he looked at the data, his decision to start Amazon would have been a bad idea. But he did it based out of, he didn't want to regret not trying it. So it's kind of interesting that he, you know, he looked at the data, but he used it as part of the decision-making process, not the decision itself.
Yeah, and you know, to go back to the issue of, you know, how could boards change themselves and how can leadership, you know, what can they do? Because we don't want to end our discussion on a negative note. You know, what could they do? Well, I'll tell you what they could do. They could hire a futurist and put them on their board. How's that for starters?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I have to tell you, I have had companies, large public companies in the energy sector, in the pharmaceutical sector and everything, come and talk to me. And they've said, you know, we're interested in having you on our board. And I will tell you, and I go, great. You know, you want a futurist, a bona fide futurist, right? Who is going to talk through these issues with you and help your C-suite, right? To make the changes necessary. And each and every time at the end of the day, they choose somebody that's got a lot of board experience in their sector.
Mm.
They never seem to add a futurist. And frankly, I'm not taking it personally. It's not like they're adding some other futurist. That I would take personally.
That's spot on. Rebecca, you're spot on.
I will feel excited when corporations, because, you know, it's interesting, and maybe we're just ahead of our time a little bit here, but it's interesting that, you know, 20 years ago, you didn't have someone who was concerned with sustainability.
Mm.
But then slowly some boards started adding somebody on that could greenwash what the bad things they were doing effectively, right? And so they go, oh, hey, we've got a sustainability person on our board. Yeah, right. You know, but they started to do that. So I have some hope that maybe they'll add, you know, this will go the way that the sustainability person was added to most public boards. There is somebody that is in charge of that. And maybe they'll start to, maybe they'll listen to this program and say, you know, we need a futurist.
That's great. I think that's a great final idea. You, Luke, anything to add to that?
Yeah, look, I completely agree. There has been a tendency that slowly but surely boards are starting to look into the space. I don't think they're mature enough yet to take on that, and it basically would be disruptive. But I also think, and this would be my closing comment, you know, looking at the futurists out there, you know, unfortunately, I think there are a great deal of futurists that just not doing the profession any favors. And that is to understand the decision-making process. You know, foresight is very much about speculating. It's about imagining. It's about developing alternatives and possibilities. But from there, we think that we are agents of decision-making, which we're not. We then hand over what we've worked on, and we communicate that. And then a different process of decision-making kicks in, usually around strategic thinking, and it usually ends up in a decision on a particular hypothesis, idea that if we do this, that'll be the outcome. We are not in that space as futurists. Sometimes we can assist in making those decisions, but our work is primarily up front. And I don't think that, and this is what's not attractive to boards, by the way, because they see through that. But I don't think that we have a mature enough profession, with obvious exceptions. There's heaps of people that do this great. But there are also more that don't understand the parameters of our profession and or are able to transition between those different stages in the decision-making process. And that's the area that as a profession, I think we need to work on.
Hmm. Very nice. So I think we'll wrap up there. And the one way I like to end this episode, each episode, is to ask each guest to provide one word that they would like to leave, you know, leadership for the future. And so, kind of a difficult challenge, but Rebecca, what was one word you'd like to leave?
Well, be rational.
Rational.
Rational, yeah. you know, don't give in to the lower traits and characteristics we share with lower animals. I mean, you know, it's taken us millions of years to develop foresight, and it is highly unnatural to squander such a phenomenal evolutionary tool. You know, most creatures will leverage the heck out of an advantage like that. And so this is rather unnatural. So I would say, you know, rational, and then along with that, foresight. Use foresight.
And Luke?
I would say just read Rebecca's books. No, well, seriously.
You're giving me too much credit there.
No. I like your thinking, Rebecca. It's wonderful. And it does get right to the issue. But I'd probably say that right next to be rational, I would say also be generative. And together, I think you would encompass that innate foresight that we all have.
Great. Well, thank you, Rebecca and Luke, for your time. Really appreciate your wisdom and insights.
An absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you, and really enjoyed speaking to both of you.
Yeah, it's been terrific. Thank you so much.
Let's do it again.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs, or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.